quickly in the carpet dealer's favor. "I'm insulted," Taylor said angrily. "I'm not going to do business with you people." "This is the best exchange rate you can get," said the carpet man.
"The hell it is.
It's very dangerous for you to be in this part of the city carrying all that money."
"I'm not alone," Taylor said. "I've got 6 people outside waiting for me."
He finished his tea and stood up. He walked slowly out of the shop and jumped into the car.
"Ali, let's get out of here, fast."
They drove north. Taylor directed Ali to another carpet dealer, an Iranian Jew with a shop near the palace. The man was just closing up when Taylor walked in.
"I need to change some dollars for reals," Taylor said.
"Come back tomorrow," said the man.
"No, I need them tonight."
"How much?"
$25,000.
"I don't have anything like that much."
"I've really got to have them tonight."
"What's it for?"
"It's to do with Paul and Bill."
The carpet dealer nodded. He had done business with several EDS people, and he knew that Paul and Bill were in jail.
"I'll see what I can do."
He called his brother from the back of the shop and sent him out. Then he opened his safe and took out all his reals. He and Taylor stood there counting money. The dealer counted the dollars and Taylor the reals. A few minutes later, a kid came in with his hands full of reals and dumped them on the counter. He left without speaking. Taylor realized the carpet dealer was rounding up all the cash he could lay his hands on. A young man came up on a motor scooter, parked outside, and walked in with a bag full of reals. While he was in the shop, someone stole his motor scooter. The young man dropped the bag of money and ran after the thief, yelling at the top of his voice. Taylor went on counting. Just another normal business day in revolutionary Tehran. John Howell was changing. With each day that went by, he became a little less the upright American lawyer and a little more the devious Persian negotiator. In particular, he began to see bribery in a different light. Mehdi, an Iranian accountant who had done occasional work for EDS, had explained things to him like this. "In Iran, many things are achieved by friendship. There are several ways to become Dadgar's friend. Me, I would sit outside his house every day until he talked to me. Another way for me to become his friend would be to give him $200,000. If you like, I could arrange something like this for you."
Howell discussed this proposal with the other members of the negotiating team. They assumed that Mehdi was offering himself as a bribe intermediary, as Deep Throat had. But this time Howell was not so quick to reject the idea of a corrupt deal for Paul and Bill's freedom. They decided to play along with Mehdi. They might be able to expose the deal and discredit Dadgar. Alternatively, they might decide the arrangement was solid and pay up. Either way, they wanted a clear sign from Dadgar that he was bribable.
Howell and Keen Taylor had a series of meetings with Mehdi. The accountant was as jumpy as Deep Throat had been and would not let the EDS people come to his office during normal working hours. He always met them early in the morning or late at night or at his house or down back alleys. Howell kept pressing him for an unmistakable signal. Dadgar was to come to a meeting wearing odd socks or with his tie on backward. Mehdi would propose ambiguous signals, such as Dadgar giving the Americans a hard time. On one occasion, Dadgar did give them a hard time, as Mehdi had forecast, but that might have happened anyway. Dadgar was not the only one giving Howell a hard time. Howell was talking to Angela on the phone every 4 or 5 days, and she wanted to know when he was coming home. He did not know. Paul and Bill were naturally pressing him for hard news, but his progress was so slow and indefinite that he could not possibly give them deadlines. He found this frustrating, and when Angela started questioning him on the same point, he had to suppress his irritation. The Mehdi initiative came to nothing. Mehdi introduced Howell to a lawyer who claimed to be close to Dadgar. The lawyer did not want a bribe, just normal legal fees. EDS retained him, but at the next meeting Dadgar said,
"Nobody has any special relationship with me. If anybody tries to tell you differently, don't believe them."
Howell was not sure what to make of all this. Had there been nothing in it right from the start? Or had EDS's caution frightened Dadgar into dropping a demand for a bribe? He would never know. On January 30th, Dadgar told Howell he was interested in Abulfat Mavi, EDS's Iranian partner. Howell began to prepare a dossier on EDS's dealings with Mavi. Howell now believed that Paul and Bill were straightforward commercial hostages. Dadgar's investigation into corruption might be genuine, but he knew by now that Paul and Bill were innocent. Therefore, he must be holding them on orders from above. The Iranians had originally wanted either their promised computerized welfare system or their money back. Giving them their welfare system meant renegotiating the contract, but the new government was not interested in renegotiating, and in any case was unlikely to stay in power long enough to consummate a deal. If Dadgar could not be bribed, convinced of Paul and Bill's innocence,
are ordered by his superiors to release them on the basis of a new contract between EDS and the ministry, there remained to Howell only one option: pay the bail. Dr. Human's efforts to get the amount reduced had come to nothing. Howell now concentrated on ways of getting $13 million from Dallas to Tehran. He had learned, bit by bit, that there was an EDS rescue team in Tehran. He was astonished that the head of an American corporation would set in motion something like that. He was also reassured, for if he could only get Paul and Bill out of jail, somebody else was standing by to get them out of Iran.
Liz Coburn was frantic with worry. She sat in the car with Tony Dvoronczyk and Tony's husband, Bill. They were heading for the Royal Tokyo restaurant. It was on Greenville Avenue, not far from Recipes, the place where Liz and Tony had drunk daiquiris with Mary Scully, and Mary had shattered Liz's world by saying, "They're all in Tehran, I guess." Since that moment, Liz had been living in constant, stark terror. Jay was everything to her. He was Captain America. He was Superman. He was her whole life. She did not see how she could live without him. The thought of losing him scared her to death. She called Tehran constantly, but never reached him. She called Merv Stoffer every day, asking, "When is Jay coming home? Is he all right? Will he get out alive?" Merv tried to soothe her, but he would not give her any information, so she would demand to speak to Ross Perot, and Merv would tell her that that was not possible. Then she would call her mother and burst into tears and pour out all her anxiety and fear and frustration over the phone. The Dvoronczyks were kind. They were trying to take her mind off her worries. "What did you do today?" Tony asked. "I went shopping," Liz said. "Did you buy anything?" "Yes." Liz started to cry. "I bought a black dress, because Jay isn't coming home."
During those days of waiting, Jay Coburn learned a good deal about Simons. One day, Merv Stoffer called from Dallas to say that Simons' son, Harry, had been on the phone, worried. Harry had called his father's house and spoken to Paul Walker, who was minding the farm. Walker had said he did not know where Simons was and advised Harry to call Merv Stoffer at EDS. Harry was naturally worried, Stoffer said. Simons called Harry from Tehran and reassured him. Simons told Coburn that Harry had had some problems, but he was a good boy at heart. He spoke of his son with a kind of resigned affection. He never mentioned Bruce, and it was not until much later that Coburn realized Simons had two sons. Simons talked a lot about his late wife Lucille and how happy the two of them had been after Simons retired. They had been very close during the last few years, Coburn gathered, and Simons seemed to regret that it had taken him so long to realize how much he loved her. "Hold on to your mate," he advised Coburn. "She's the most important person in your life." Paradoxically, Simons' advice had the opposite effect on Coburn. He envied the companionship Simons and Lucille had had, and he wanted that for himself. But he was so sure he could never achieve it with Liz that he wondered if someone else would be his true soulmate. One evening, Simons laughed and said, "You know, I wouldn't do this for anyone else." It was a characteristically cryptic Simons remark. Sometimes, Coburn had learned, you got an explanation. Sometimes you did not. This time, Coburn got an explanation. Simons told him why he felt indebted to Ross Perot. The aftermath of the Sun Tai raid had been a bitter experience for Simons. Although the raiders had not brought back any American POWs, it had been a brave try, and Simons expected the American public to see it that way. Indeed, he had argued, at a breakfast meeting with Defense Secretary Melvin Laird in favor of releasing the news of the raid to the press. "This is a perfectly legitimate operation," he had told Laird. "These are American prisoners. This is something Americans traditionally do for Americans. For Christ's sake, what is it we're afraid of here?" He soon found out. The press and the public saw the raid as a failure, and yet another intelligence foul-up. The banner headline on the front page of the next day's Washington Post read, "U.S. Raid to Rescue POWs Fails." When Senator Robert Dole introduced a resolution praising the raid and said, "Some of these men have been languishing in prison for 5 years, Senator Kennedy replied, "And they're still there." Simons went to the White House to receive the Distinguished Service Cross for extraordinary heroism from President Nixon. The rest of the raiders were to be decorated by Defense Secretary Laird. Simons was enraged to learn that over half his men were to get nothing more than the Army Commendation Ribbon, only slightly better than a Good Conduct Ribbon, and known to soldiers as a Green Weenie. Mad as hell, he picked up the phone and asked for the Army Chief of Staff General Westmoreland. He got Acting Chief General Palmer. Simons told Palmer about the Green Weenies and said, "General, I don't want to embarrass the Army, but one of my men is just likely to shove an Army Commendation Ribbon up Mr. Laird's ass." He got his way. Laird awarded 4 Distinguished Service Crosses, 50 Silver Stars, and no Green Weenies. The POWs got a huge morale boost from the Sun Tai raid, which they heard about from incoming prisoners. An important side effect of the raid was that the POW camps, where many prisoners had been kept permanently in solitary confinement, were closed, and all the Americans were brought into two large prisons where there was not enough room to keep them apart. Nevertheless, the world branded the raid a failure, and Simons felt a grave injustice had been done to his men. The disappointment rankled with him for years, until one weekend Ross Perot threw a mammoth party in San Francisco, persuaded the army to round up the Sun Tai raiders from all over the world and introduce them to the prisoners they had tried to rescue. That weekend, Simons felt, his raiders had at last got the thanks they deserved, and Ross Perot had been responsible. "That's why I'm here," Simons told Coburn. "Sure as hell I wouldn't do this for anyone else." Coburn, thinking of his son Scott, knew exactly what Simons meant.
On January 22nd, hundreds of Homopars, young Air Force officers, mutinied at bases in Dezful, Hamadan, Isfahan, and Mashhad, and declared themselves loyal to the Ayatollah Khomeini. The significance of the event was not apparent to National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, who still expected the Iranian military to crush the Islamic Revolution, nor to Premier Shapur Bakhtiar, who was talking about meeting the revolutionary challenge with a minimum of force, nor to the Shah, who instead of going to the United States, was hanging on in Egypt, waiting to be summoned back to save his country in its hour of need. Among the people who did see its significance were Ambassador William Sullivan and General Abbas Gharbaghi, the Iranian Chief of Staff. Sullivan told Washington that the idea of a pro-Shah counter-coup was moonshine, the revolution was going to succeed, and the U.S. had better start thinking about how it would live with the new order. He received a harsh reply from the White House suggesting that he was disloyal to the president. He decided to resign, but his wife talked him out of it. He had a responsibility to the thousands of Americans still in Iran, she pointed out, and he could hardly walk out on them now. General Gharbaghi also contemplated resigning. He was in an impossible position. He had sworn his oath of loyalty not to the parliament or the government of Iran, but to the Shah personally, and the Shah was gone. For the time being, Gharbaghi took the view that the military owed loyalty to the Constitution of 1906, but that meant little in practice. Theoretically, the military ought to support the Bakhtiar government. Gharbaghi had been wondering for some weeks whether he could rely on his soldiers to follow orders and fight for Bakhtiar against the revolutionary forces. The revolt of the Homopars showed that he could not. He realized, as Brzezinski did not, that an army was not a machine to be switched on and off at will, but a collection of people, sharing the aspirations, the anger, and the revivalist religion of the rest of the country. The soldiers wanted a revolution as much as the civilians. Gharbaghi concluded that he could no longer control his troops, and he decided to resign. The soldiers wanted a revolution as much as the civilians. Gharbaghi concluded that he could no longer control his troops, and he decided to resign. On the day that he announced his intention to his fellow generals, Ambassador William Sullivan was summoned to Prime Minister Bakhtiar's office at 6 o'clock in the evening. Sullivan had heard from U.S. General Dutch Heiser of Gharbaghi's intended resignation, and he assumed that this was what Bakhtiar wanted to talk about. Bakhtiar waved Sullivan to a seat, saying with an enigmatic smile, "Nous serons trois. There will be three of us." Bakhtiar always spoke French with Sullivan. A few minutes later, General Gharbaghi walked in. Bakhtiar spoke of the difficulties that would be created if the general were to resign. Gharbaghi began to reply in Farsi, but Bakhtiar made him speak French. As the general talked, he toyed with what seemed to be an envelope in his pocket. Sullivan guessed it was his letter of resignation. As the two Iranians argued in French, Bakhtiar kept turning to the American ambassador for support. Sullivan secretly thought Gharbaghi was absolutely right to resign, but his orders from the White House were to encourage the military to support Bakhtiar, so he doggedly argued against his own convictions that Gharbaghi should not resign. After a discussion of half an hour, the general left without delivering his letter of resignation. Bakhtiar thanked Sullivan profusely for his help. Sullivan knew it would do no good. On January 24th, Bakhtiar closed Tehran's airport to stop Khomeini from entering Iran. It was like opening an umbrella against a tidal wave. On January 26th, soldiers killed 15 pro-Khomeini protesters in street fighting in Tehran. 2 days later, Bakhtiar offered to go to Paris for talks with the Ayatollah. For a ruling prime minister to offer to visit an exiled rebel was a fantastic admission of weakness, and Khomeini saw it that way. He refused to talk unless Bakhtiar first resigned. On January 29th, 35 people died in the fighting in Tehran and another 50 in the rest of the country. Gharbaghi, bypassing his prime minister, began talks with the rebels in Tehran and gave his consent to the return of the Ayatollah. On January 30th, Sullivan ordered the evacuation of all non-essential embassy personnel and all dependents. On February 1st, Khomeini came home. His Air France jumbo jet landed at 9:15 a.m. 2 million Iranians turned out to greet him. At the airport, the Ayatollah made his first public statement. I beg God to cut off the hands of all evil foreigners and all their helpers. Simons saw it all on TV. Then he said to Coburn, That's it. The people are going to do it for us. The mob will take that jail.
Chapter 9. At midday on February 5th, John Howell was on the point of getting Paul and Bill out of jail. Dadgar had said that he would accept bail in one of three forms, cash, a bank guarantee, or a lien on property. Cash was out of the question. First, anyone who flew into the lawless city of Tehran with $12,750,000 in a suitcase might never reach Dadgar's office alive. Second, Dadgar might take the money and still keep Paul and Bill, either by raising the bail or by rearresting them on some new pretext. Tom Walter suggested using counterfeit money, but nobody knew where to get it. There had to be a document that gave Dadgar the money and at the same time gave Paul and Bill their freedom. In Dallas, Tom Walter had at last found a bank, willing to issue a letter of credit for the bail. But Howell and Taylor were having trouble finding an Iranian bank to accept it and issue the guarantee Dadgar required. Meanwhile, Howell's boss, Tom Luce, thought about the third option, a lien on property, and came up with a wild and wacky idea that just might work, pledging the U.S. Embassy in Tehran as bail for Paul and Bill. The State Department was by now loosening up, but was not quite ready to pledge its Tehran embassy as bail. However, it was ready to give the guarantee of the United States government. That in itself was unique, the USA standing bail for two jailed men. First, Tom Walter in Dallas got a bank to issue a letter of credit in favor of the State Department for $12,750,000. Because this transaction took place entirely within the U.S., it was accomplished in hours rather than days. Once the State Department in Washington had the letter, Minister Counselor Charles Ness, Ambassador Sullivan's deputy, would deliver a diplomatic note saying that Paul and Bill, once released, would make themselves available to Dadgar for questioning. Otherwise, the bail would be paid by the embassy. Right now, Dadgar was in a meeting with Lou Gohls, Consul General at the embassy. Howell had not been invited to attend, but Abul Hassan was there for EDS. Howell had had a preliminary meeting with Gohls yesterday. Together, they'd gone over the terms of the guarantee, with Gohls reading the phrases in his quiet, precise voice. Gohls was changing. 2 months ago, Howell had found him maddeningly correct. It was Gohls who had refused to give back Paul and Bill's passports without telling the Iranians. Now, Gohls seemed ready to try the unconventional. Perhaps living in the middle of a revolution had made the old boy unbend a little. Gohls had told Howell that the decision to release Paul and Bill would be made by Prime Minister Bakhtiar, but it must first be cleared with Dadgar. Howell was hoping Dadgar would not make trouble, for Gohls was not the type of man to bang the table and force Dadgar to back down. There was a tap at the door, and Abul Hassan walked in. Howell could tell from his face that he brought bad news. What happened? He turned us down, Abul Hassan said. Why? He won't accept the guarantee of the United States government. Did he give a reason? There's nothing in the law that says he can accept that as bail. He has to have cash, a bank guarantee, or a lien on property, I know. Howell felt numb. There'd been so many disappointments, so many dead ends, he was no longer capable of resentment or anger. Did you say anything about the Prime Minister? Yes. Gohls told him we would take this proposal to Bakhtiar. What did Dadgar say to that? He said it was typical of the Americans. They try to resolve things by bringing influence to bear at high levels, with no concern for what is happening at lower levels. He also said that if his superiors did not like the way he was handling this case, they could take him off it, and he would be very happy because he was weary of it. Howell frowned. What did all this mean? He had recently concluded that what the Iranians really wanted was the money. Now they had flatly turned it down. Was this genuinely because of the technical problem that the law did not specify a government guarantee as an acceptable form of bail? Or was that an excuse? Perhaps it was genuine. The EDS case had always been politically sensitive, and now that the Ayatollah had returned, Dadgar might well be terrified of doing anything that could be construed as pro-American. Bending the rules to accept an unconventional form of bail might get him into trouble. What would happen if Howell succeeded in putting up bail in the legally required form? Would Dadgar then feel he had covered his rear and released Paul and Bill? Or would he invent another excuse? There was only one way to find out.
The week the Ayatollah returned to Iran, Paul and Bill asked for a priest. Paul's cold seemed to have turned to bronchitis. He had asked for the prison doctor. The doctor did not speak English, but Paul had no trouble explaining his problem. He coughed, and the doctor nodded. Paul was given some pills